In the case of Royal Robbins, he's a person who shifts the focus of climbing, maybe temporarily, but he shifts it to America from the Alps. Hard climbing, progress in climbing, the vision of climbing gets a new center, and technical rock climbing is given kind of a world capital in Yosemite.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of Climbing on the Bookshelf. I trust you're all well and enjoyed my last episode and rated and reviewed the podcast, but if you haven't, please do have a listen and then take just a quick moment to leave your rating and review, as this really helps other people find and hopefully enjoy my show. Thank you. This episode, I was really excited that I managed to line up this guest, with a great many thanks to Marissa Lytak from Mountaineers Books, as it was with who I think is the modern-day go-to writer of biographies, if your subject is important and key historical figures that influenced climbing in general as we know it today. I'm talking about, of course, writer and climbing lifer, David Smart. He is the founding editor of Gripped magazine for more than 25 years. He's written climbing guidebooks and has developed over 300 routes. He has also won the Boardman Tasker Award and the Banff Mountain Literature Award with his book on Emilio Camici, shortlisted for the Banff Mountain Book Award and the Boardman Tasker Award for his book on Paul Preuss, written articles for Alpinist and various other climbing magazines. Is there anything else that this man will do? Well, if you listen very carefully, then you might just find out what he's working on for his next project. His latest book, Royal Robbins, The American Climber, certainly doesn't fail to live up to his past writings and quality of research you've come to expect from such a brilliant writer. We do eventually get to talk about his new book, which has been out for a little while now, but if you haven't done so already and feel like picking up a copy after you've listened, then head over to your usual bookseller and buy it now. I really hope you all enjoy as much as I did this trip down memory lane and the storied history that comes with climbing greats.
Hello, can you hear me now?
I can hear you. Can you hear me?
Very loud and clear. That's brilliant. I knew we'd get there in the end. How are you anyway? You all right?
Excellent. Excellent. How are you doing?
Good. Very well. A little bit nervous, but I'm always a little bit nervous, but that's a good thing, I think.
Where are you in the UK?
I'm in the southeast, so in between the south coast and London. So there's no climbing around. It's just the one area where I pick. It's just typical, isn't it, really?
Yeah.
Yeah. How about you? Whereabouts are you in the world?
I'm in Ontario, in Toronto.
Okay. So forgive me for my very bad geography, but whereabouts is that?
Sort of in the middle of Canada.
Okay.
Barely, relatively far north, but
Sure.
Kind of in the east-west sense of things.
What sort of time is it over there? Because it's 7 o'clock in the evening here.
Yeah, it's 3 p.m. because
we
just had a daylight savings time.
Oh, we're just about to have that quite soon, I think, within a week or so,
right.
Where our clocks go forward an hour. Sure. So that would have added a bit of an extra complication if we'd have done it that weekend, I think. But thankfully, we'd arranged it for this, which is great. So thank you so much for agreeing to have a bit of a chat and stuff. I really appreciate your time. And if it wasn't for Marissa Lytak at Mountaineers Books, I probably wouldn't have had the courage to get in touch with you, I think. So so thank you. Thank you, Marissa.
Yes,
and
yes.
Thank you for agreeing to do it. I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome.
So, David Smart, welcome to Climbing on the Bookshelf.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
So the guidebooks, what were they guidebooks on? Were they just on climbing routes or based in Canada? Or tell me about those.
Yes, they were guidebooks to climbing in Canada, to rock climbing, specifically in provinces of Quebec and Ontario. They're not sort of on the main path of climbing, but this is where I grew up. And they were sort of as much as they were, you know, records of climbing routes, they were also sort of diaries and memoirs of small communities of people who often kind of eccentric, out of the way of the mainstream climbing people who I knew and the adventures we had sort of inventing climbing as we went along.
Right. Okay. And you've also wrote a biography about Paul Preuss, which was shortlisted for the Borden Tasker Prize. Incredible. How did you take it that you were shortlisted for that?
Oh, I was tremendously excited. I know, the Boardman Tasker Prize is the most prestigious prize available in climbing, mountaineering literature. And so to have a book that gets that kind of recognition from people who really who love and are so committed to the genre of writing that I write in is definitely pretty excited.
Yeah, sure, I'm sure you were. And then the following year you wrote the book, which I have actually read, about Emilio Camici.
Yes, and I've
actually got a copy of it in front of me here now. But you won the Banff Award for Climbing Literature on that as well, which is incredible.
Yeah, and the Boardman Tasker Prize.
Yeah, that's amazing. Well done that. That's really good. And then there was, it's just award after award, really. The H. Adams Carter Award for Mountain Literature from the American Alpine Club.
Right, yes.
And then you, a lot of your work has appeared in Climbing, Rock and Ice, the American Alpine Journal, the Canadian Alpine Journal, Alpinist. Is there anything in climbing writing that you would still like to do or achieve?
Oh, yes.
It seems that you've got quite a lot, a big long list of amazing things that you've done already.
Well, I love to write, and climbing books have always been, I read a lot too, and climbing books have always just been such a genre I loved and immersed myself in. And so, I the only reason really to write, it's much like climbing, is because you can't stop yourself. And I am like that about writing. There's always more things to do. Right now, I'm working on a history of the 500,000 year history of climbing that won't actually be a very long book. It's more on the development and the philosophy of climbing. It's just going to be called On Climbing.
Okay.
And fantastic. So, I'm working on that, which is, it's not long, but it's a very complicated process writing something like that.
Sure.
So I have no real timeline on that, but there are lots of people I would like still write biography about, and I'm sort of looking at some different subjects right now, but I'm not settled on something.
Just
a British climber, for instance. I would like to write a book about a British climber. I'm not researching Joe Brown right now, but he's certainly somebody who, you know, he really moved the markers in terms of class and performance and technical achievement, and gave British rock climbing a sort of international status in many ways. Nobody operates totally alone, but I think he's an individual who I would think of. Another thing with the British climbing is, like, in many ways invented the genre. Like, there's so many, been so many incredible books written by about British climbers that there's that standard also to think about if you were to write a book about a British climber. So
So you're a climber yourself as well.
Yes.
So how long have you been climbing, and how did you get hooked? When did it start?
I've been climbing since must be 1977, 78.
Wow.
And,
okay.
I got hooked because I was a small amount of exposure through day camp as a child.
Okay. Yep.
Just some like rappelling and things like that. And then I was hiking out at a local cliff, Rattlesnake Point. No rattlesnakes there.
No, okay.
There were people out there rock climbing, and in the 70s, you know, in many ways it was the opposite of how it is now. If anyone who showed up to climb, who wanted to learn, you know, how to climb and to participate, there were so few people like that that, you know, it was easier to get people to mentor you. You know, it was a community of experts with no beginners, no apprentices.
Okay, yeah.
And now it's the opposite in many ways, of course. And so I got involved with some guys who were, they were going down to the Shawangunks, which is not all that far from where I live.
Okay.
And that was sort of like one of the great centers of rock climbing in the United States. And I started going down there and, you know, I was just like this sort of idle person, like the kind of the perfect kind of sponge to soak up climbing culture.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And like, you know, in many cases, I think people don't kind of become climbers. They sort of realize they always were at least potentially climbers. I was like that. And I just, no looking back, Dave Smart was gone. He was climbing.
Yeah, it's quite often the case is that when a few people, they all say that, you know, we did like a Boy Scout camp and we had climbing there and then. And
yes, yeah. And I was lucky because although the city I was born in, Toronto, is fairly far from serious established climbing, there are actually lots of cliffs to climb on. But it's big enough that no matter what kind of hobby or pastime you want to be involved in, there's somebody here doing it. Okay. And there were people here at the time who were very involved in climbing, not just in the Gunks, as we called the Shawangunks, but Yosemite. I was able to get down to Yosemite at a fairly young age.
Okay, incredible.
With them. And so that was a lucky stroke for me.
Yeah, nice. So after all your sort of climbing exploits and things and enjoying it, where or what was your motivation or inspiration to start writing about climbing?
Well, I think climbing, almost as soon as I started doing it, because I wasn't in a place where I was like totally immersed with a climbing community. I had a sort of weekday suburban life, going to school and so on, where I didn't have that exposure. So I got books from the library to read, and I learned climbing stories and culture partly from that and partly from the climbers who were telling me about climbing. And in Canada, we didn't invent climbing ourselves here.
Okay.
There's sort of more of a sense in the United States, although it isn't true, that Americans invented American climbing. But here it was very much, you know, it was brought here by British climbers, by climbers from Central and Europe. And and we learned all their stories too, which is maybe why I ended up writing a book about Paul Freud, and as well as American climbing, because it's close to us. So I always had a sense of climbing as a place with all these different overlapping narratives, maybe they all overlapped mostly in my own mind. But just understanding what was so important to me and the stories of people who had gone before me or created its values, and so on. They just, as soon as I read them, they mattered to me. Hard to know why.
Sure. It just sort of struck a chord with you.
Yeah. Yes, absolutely.
So with your books that you've written so far, they've all been absolutely phenomenal in my eyes anyway. Probably everybody else that is into climbing and mountaineering, they all know about it, they all know who you are, so they almost kind of come to expect a good quality bit of general research and things like that into your books. So how do you go about researching Paul Preuss, for example, or Emilio Camici?
Well,
for example,
Paul Preuss and Emilio Camici were mostly a matter of, the archives of European Alpine clubs, the German Alpine club, the Austrian Alpine club, CAI, the Club Alpino Italiano, they are formidable. They are formidable. They have, you know, the Alpine club, the Club Alpino Italiano has an archive in a castle.
Wow.
And
okay.
The castle was given to them by a countess who had been a member. And there's a two-volume illustrated history of the archive.
So have you? Did you visit? Have you been there?
Yes, I have.
You have. Wow. Yeah.
And so you can get an enormous amount of material online or by writing or by asking archives to provide you copies. And then I went to various places that had archives or that I thought had archives. In Italy, Austria, Germany. And I spoke to other historians and writers on the subjects. And, you know, sometimes people in Paul Preuss's case and in Emilio Comici's case, his relatives are still alive. In Comici's case, I was speaking in Belluno. And not in Belluno, in Cortina. No, sorry, I'm going back on that. It was Belluno. And there was, someone said, well, have you, you know, is everybody... Everyone who knew Emilio, who died in 1940, dead. And I said, as far as I know, it was like, you know, mostly an archival project. And then someone said, yes, but Renato Zanuti, who climbed with Emilio when he was 16 for a day, he's still alive. He's 103. So wow, you never quite know. And what, you know, who's around to speak to these people and to their lives, but it was largely archival projects with,
so they're sort of like stories from people that saw him climb or whatever, or there's no like first-hand accounts or something like that that you'd find somewhere.
Some of them are, you know, in Preuss's case, Tita Piaz, in Comici's case, many people saw him climb. In Comici's case, there's a challenge that he didn't climb with much, sometimes, but not much with his equals.
Yeah.
And when these top climbers climb with people who aren't as good as them, the accounts, which is everybody almost, except for a handful of people who are maybe off doing their own climbing, in Comici's case, were his rivals. So people tended to say he climbed like a god. It was effortless and so on.
Yes.
And, in the case of Paul Preuss and Royal Robbins, who climbed with other very strong people, you have more diversity of opinion about their ability.
Yes. Yeah, sure. You just mentioned Tita Piaz. His name keeps coming up every now and again.
Yes.
So do you think he might have been a little bit overshadowed by by others, and because I've recently spoken to John Middendorf.
Yes,
And
he's an expert.
he's does so much research and things, and he brought up his name as well.
Yeah.
So obviously, this Tita Piaz is quite a climber as well.
Yeah, Tita Piaz was an incredible climber, and he had a very strong friendship with Preuss, and they climbed together. Hans Dulfer, the other leading climber, he climbed with Preuss. Preuss came into conflict with Piaz over the use of pitons. Piaz was somebody who believed in the moderate use of pitons. And Piaz gives he's a sort of at times searingly honest writer. He wrote a fair amount. He was a very strong person morally. He ended up in the jails of for his radical politics of three different regimes temporarily.
Yes.
And he was incredibly strong. And in ways, Preuss, when he's trying to make his reputation, he's following Piaz's lead. Piaz's roots are sort of set the standard for what could be done, like hard rock climbs. And it's Preuss looking at these routes and deciding that he can do these types of things without pitons.
Yes.
You know, he's not inventing hard climbing on his own. Yes.
Your new book, Royal Robbins, The American Climber, I'd say I start with a pun. It's got the smart treatment. I was really kindly sent a digital copy of the book from Mountaineers Books. But to be honest, I've only got about 100 pages in before I'm speaking to you now.
Sure.
And I absolutely still plan on reading the rest. I just need to pick up an actual physical book. Right. But that's what I really like, is reading. I find it quite difficult to read on a tablet or a phone or something.
Yeah, me too.
I just like the way it feels in your hand, and you're a bit more connected to the person rather than on like a glowing screen, which is like bad for you apparently. So, which is the one of the reasons why I haven't read it. So I'd love, not haven't read it, but haven't finished reading it. Right. I'd love to hear about how you came to write about Royal Robins. And actually, just before this, you just said about Paul Preuss and Tito Piaz, about the Piton War. Now, there seems to be some kind of similarity going on when Royal Robins and Warren Harding were about. I know, I do know that they were supposed to be at loggerheads of each other, but I know they did actually get on and climb with each other.
Yeah. I suppose when I'm looking for subjects, I'm looking for people whose lives in climbing really changed the direction everything went. Nobody works in total isolation. Paul Preuss came close, but even he like needed other people, at least as foils, for what he did. And in Comici's case, he might have mostly been the most famous big wall climber who sort of invents big wall climbing and big wall climbing's image by going after the biggest walls, the biggest routes. Other people are coming closer or maybe even doing slightly harder things, but he ends up being the figurehead. In the case of Royal Robins, he's a person who shifts the focus of climbing, maybe temporarily, but he shifts it to America from the Alps. Hard climbing, progress in climbing, the vision of climbing gets a new center, and technical rock climbing is given kind of a world capital in Yosemite in a way kind of no particular place ever had that geographically in the Alps or in Europe. Hard climbing here and there, different climbs in different places, but Yosemite, which is such a no place in American climbing that the American Alpine Journal doesn't write about it. Even after the first ascent of the Salathe Wall, they put a little note in, but
that's incredible.
Yeah, and you know, Royal arrives as he's 18 years old, and he walks up to Alan Steck, who is the only kind of Dolomites trained big wall climber in America. And he's done a couple of these things like the Steck Salathe in Yosemite. But he's also done Comici's routes, which are the template for these big wall routes, multi-day big wall routes.
Such as the Cima Grande, things like
that. Yes, he's done that, yeah.
Yeah.
And the northwest face of the Civetta, which is, to me, like much more...
It's quite severe. Yes.
Frightening. Yes. But so 18 or 17, I can't remember, but Royal walks up to Steck and says, "So, do you have anything around here worth climbing?" And then Steck is kind of nonplussed at this, but you know, in a way, Royal's life provides the answer, right?
Yeah.
But and he, you know, he invents. It's just things from trivial things like the American climbing road trip, where you get in a car and you drive to all these different areas. People tended not to, you know, nobody really did that before he did. He did it to kind of make his name, to do something hard in all these different areas.
Different places,
that used to be a thing in, I don't know, probably it still is, in British climbing, that like, you couldn't just make your reputation with a hard route in, you know, North Wales. You also had to have something in the peak.
So, yes, exactly.
Yeah. And so Royal did that there. And he invented this big wall climbing idiom. You know, there were other people doing it, and he goaded other people to do things. And, you know, full credit to Harding for doing the nose, but he might not have done it if he hadn't been squeezed out of the first ascent of the northwest face of Half Dome pretty directly by Royal. And then Royal went, and it's like if Harding did something, he improved on it style-wise. He did it faster. He did it continuously. He introduced the idea of free climbing these old aid routes. And then eventually he introduced clean climbing from the UK. He was in Switzerland in the Alps, and he did these new routes on the Drew. And he loved climbing in the UK and UK climbing culture. He brought the world to Yosemite as part. He didn't just invent Yosemite as this great place. He went out and, like, you know, proselytized about its greatness and brought people there. So I think he really invented. He was sort of the architect of that whole post-war era of the discovery of Yosemite and this you know, pristine kind of granite image of big walls and all this kind of stuff. And that's why I chose him.
There's also in the book, there is the foreword, and you chose John Long to write the foreword.
Yes.
Why did you choose him for that? I'm not saying why on earth did you choose him? I'm saying,
yeah,
why did you choose John Long for the foreword for the book?
Well, I've always, you know, admired John's writing, and he's sort of kept up a standard of literary writing in climbing. He was one of the first writers that I knew, and I thought, geez, you know, I'd really like to write like John Long. I'm sure I have some buried material someplace that comes pretty close to imitating his style from a long time ago. John's was a figure in the Stonemasters period that, you know, followed closely on or overlapped with the end of the so-called golden age of Yosemite climbing. And he stayed with Royal in Colorado. He knew him. He knows the family, and a formidable American climber, you know, one of the great climbing writers.
Do you know if he climbed with him at all?
Yeah, he must have to some degree, but it doesn't.
There was that crossover, yeah.
Yeah, it doesn't. He would have for sure in Colorado in any case, but it's not a part of John's story that I'm directly familiar with.
Okay, yeah, sure. At the moment, I'm up to the point where Royal stopped climbing for about a year and a half ish,
right?
Like the sort of like the mid 50s. Yeah. Do you know why he stopped? Or maybe the answer, I'm just like a few pages away from the answer. I don't know. I haven't got to that yet. but can you remember why he stopped climbing for a bit? He wasn't fed up of it, surely.
Well, I think he was worried that, like, I think a lot of people who immerse themselves in climbing and similar things happened to me, but, you know, occasionally. Yeah. Not anymore. Now that I'm old and wise enough to know that not to stop climbing. But when you're younger, you can tend to get to a point where you go, "What am I doing with my life? I mean, I'm spending all this time climbing rocks. Shouldn't I like go straight and get a job at the bank and be an upstanding American?" And you know, Royal was he wanted to be self-reliant. He grew up, as you know from reading the beginning of the book, in this state of like.
Very difficult for him, wasn't it? I believe.
Poverty and you know, people use the term lightly, but it, you know, this his family was poor, and and I think he wanted to, and you know, it's the 1950s, America's ascendant, the American dream is right there. Yeah. People who want to, you know, you want to work, have a job, move forward. Buy house, car. Like it was an age where upward, you know, economic mobility was all around you. And you know, I think he just was wondering, have I gone down a rabbit hole with this crazy hobby?
There's no such thing as sponsorship then either, was there? I guess
there was no sponsorship.
No, it was just for the sake of doing it. Yeah,
and. He snaps out of that.
And he probably comes back with a vengeance, I'm sure.
He comes back with a vengeance, absolutely. Yeah. But he had, you know, and there were other, you know, impediments. Like there was a military conscription. You had to go and serve this time in the army and,
and
so on. So, but he comes back for sure, ready to climb.
Yeah, sort of in that sort of mid to late 50s, I guess, isn't it?
Yeah, in a way, like Half Dome is kind of the his statement that he's back.
Would it be all right? Do you have the book in front of you? Or do you have the book with you?
Absolutely.
You do. Do you think it would be okay if you could do a reading from it?
Sure. So I'm going to read a little section about Royal's first serious climbing trip to the UK. So this would be in, I believe, 1966. And Royal has been working at the International School of Mountaineering in Lausanne, and he gets invited to come to the UK. So Royal soon found himself back in the media limelight. The British Broadcasting Company's plans for an April 1966 live broadcast of an ascent of the 400-foot red wall at the Gogarth Sea Cliff in Anglesey were threatened when one of the climbers, Chris Bonington, was injured. "I was very aware that live television with climbing was acting," said the program's technical director, John Clear. "I felt that live television climbing needed actors' repartee, and so the climbers had to be selected for that, not just because they were good climbers. We had Joe Brown, Ian McNaught Davis, and Scottish climber and Dr. Tom Patey, who had it." Rusty Bailey had introduced Clear to Royal in a Chamonix bar the year before. "And one was rather in awe of the chap," said Bailey. "Who were we to climb with him? But I thought, why not bring in Royal, who was calm, cool, and collected? It might also mean the broadcast could be sold in America." As an extra incentive, a lecture tour by Royal about American climbing was planned. In Patey's words, Royal suppressed some of his sphinx-like inscrutability to make friends on the set. "Was brilliant working with Royal," said Clear. "He was always ready with a wry joke. He went very well in the UK." In an oft-repeated on-screen joke, Royal said he could always tell a good aid climber by the lack of scars on their hands. Patey's hands were covered in cuts and scrapes from struggling with techniques, as unfamiliar to him as they were to most British climbers. Royal received a check for £50 and an introduction to every climber with access to a television in Britain. He also found a community where he felt less restrained than he had in Yosemite. At the Anglesey after party, he surprised the British climbers by standing on a table and singing. Bev Clark introduced Royal to London climber and surgeon Max Gammon. Marianne Faithfull, Mick Jagger, and climbing stars Mick Burke and Dougal Haston were regulars at Gammon's parties in swinging London, and Gammon put Royal on the guest list. "At the party," said Gammon, "Royal hung back, but I immediately knew that I'd found someone special. Of course, I knew about his accomplishments, but there was something else as well. When I was a child, I always tried to catch a Camberwell Beauty butterfly, but I never really knew what one looked like until I saw one. Royal was one of those people who you knew right when you met him was someone special like that." So that's a bit of background to Royal's introduction to the UK. And he definitely ended up falling in love with the place. He returned many times.
That's incredible. Thank you so much for that. I really appreciate that. That was amazing. I must read that bit. When I read it, I'll think, he read that to me. That's it. When you were being judged at Banff for the Royal Robins book, there was a quote from Jennifer Loanker. I'm sure that everybody's heard this thing, and I'll just quote it now. "It's rare to read an account of a legend that measures up to the individual, capturing visionary character in human and place with clear insight to an era, an evocative and intimate view of Royal Robins and his exceptional position in the history of American climbing."
Right.
I think that's really good. So thank you for writing that. It was really good. Thank you for writing the book, should I say. It's really good. I've really enjoyed what I've read so far, and will probably continue to read to continue to enjoy your books when you do them in the future. So thank you. Amazing. Thank you. Where can we get hold of the book? And do you have like a preferred seller? I know there's Mountaineers books over in Seattle, I think it is, in the States, but obviously I'm in the UK.
Yeah, I'm not sure who the best seller is to get it from in the UK. But
it's not something like Amazon. I know it's
Amazon,
on Amazon
or
but,
something like that. Yeah.
I've had a really great time listening to your story and listen, your reading was amazing. Thank you so much for that. I really appreciate that.
Thank you, Stuart. Thanks for inviting me.
If anybody wanted to get hold of you, how would they do that?
They can do it through the gripped.com website. Okay. But like, I mean, if you know anyone who needs to get in touch with me about the book or anything, you can just give them
a
link.
Sure.
Okay. Thanks so much, Stuart. It was really fun talking to you.
Okay. All right. Yeah. And you. Thanks so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
Okay. Bye-bye.